Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am so honored today to have somebody who, she has a lot of stories to tell about her books, but we're going to start today with a wonderful, the third book in her new series, Fairmile series, and it is called Dawnlands. I am so happy to welcome Philippa Gregory to Joy on Paper. Hi, Philippa.
Oh, hello. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lovely to be with you.
Well, thank you. And it's just, for me, it's an honor and a joy because I love your work. I moved to England when I was 21 years old from Michigan because I loved England so much and I loved English history. And so you can imagine that how thrilled I get with your books.
That's really lovely. Thank you so much. I'm so glad.
And of course, with your accent, it makes me feel, it just brings all sorts of wonderful memories back. And this new book is just, first of all, the cover, didn't they do a beautiful job? It's an amazing cover. Just gorgeous.
It's really lovely, isn't it? Yes, I'm really pleased with it.
And of course, I couldn't even start to list all the things that you've, all of the awards you've won, but you're a New York Times bestselling author, and many of my listeners, I'm sure, have read The Other Boleyn Girl, and which was made into a film. So they know your name. They know that, I am such an enthusiast for, in general, British, anything British. So tell us about this wonderful series. It's so apropos because it has both a tie-in to the new king and also to Thanksgiving Day here in America, because you have a very interesting character in, you know, to relate a story here about America.
Absolutely. In previous books in the series, there were two previous ones, starting Tidelands and then Dark Tides. We established that this is a trading family in England. They've got a small wharf on the side of the Thames, and one of the brother of the founding matriarch of the family, Ned, goes to New England to escape the restoration of Charles II because he's an old Cromwellian soldier. So a lot of Dark Tides is set actually in Hadley in Connecticut, and I had the enormous pleasure of visiting there and looking at the countryside and looking at the historic houses in that area and meeting also with the Poconocop people who took me to their tribal homelands, and I asked them if they would give me permission to research and write about their story, and they were so generous with their time and so keen that their story should be told. They are the nation that greeted the Pilgrim Fathers. It is them who gave turkeys on Thanksgiving Day. It is them who made actually the survival of the colonists possible in the first few years. And of course, it's them who were the victims of the first really terrible colonial war, which we sometimes call now King Philip's War. And my character, Rowan, is a survivor from that war. And Ned, the old Cromwellian soldier, is determined to go home to England because he knows that civil war is coming in England, another civil war. He thinks that the new king, James II, will be driven from the throne by people who don't want a Roman Catholic king. And as he's embarking in Boston Harbor, he sees some slaves being taken to the West Indies, the enslaved Native American people, the Poconocot. And one of them calls out his name, and it's Rowan, who knew him when he was the ferryman at Hadley. And he takes her as his servant to England. And from there, in a sense, the whole discussion about what it is to be free starts, because he's fighting against tyranny and monarchy, and she absolutely recognizes that the cause of English working class people is in many ways her cause, that she too wants to fight against the tyranny of the Stuart family.
Well, I thought this was a wonderful addition to the entire storyline. And you're right, it's important that people remember. And generally speaking, I don't think most Americans even know what tribe it was, but what they did and how they really, you know, helped the pilgrims when they came to the United States is a story that we should know about and appreciate these people.
It's an extraordinary story, and a lot of the tragedy of it comes from the misunderstanding of what we're talking about. So the English colonists wanted to come and claim land and hold legal title to it, and that's what they sometimes captured, sometimes conned, and sometimes paid for. And the Poconocop people didn't understand land as something that could be held by somebody legally. What they understood was the use of land. So they said, yes, it's perfectly fine that you should farm here, but don't let your pigs go into the stream or whatever, don't let your pigs come over on our crops. So they thought that it would be possible to live alongside the colonists. And for the first generation, you see this real attempt, actually on both sides, to live equably together. But the troubles in England and in Europe meant that more and more white people were coming to America, and there was more and more of a demand for land, which the Poconocot couldn't possibly satisfy and live in their traditional way. And, you know, in the winter inland, in the forest, in the summer going down to the sea and using, you know, eating of seafood and the bounty of the sea. And there's a whole, I mean, it's a really tragic collision between two cultures, which I imagine you can see all around the world still today, between the white belief, the colonial belief in ownership, and the first American belief in use and living in a harmonious relationship with the land.
Well, I found Rowan so fascinating. And of course, you have several chapters there that are told from her perspective. And I love this deep sort of dive into Barbados, because so much of it that you wrote about, I didn't know. And I found this entire subject so fascinating.
It was very fascinating to me. In a sense, I was forced to go to Barbados. I have to say, no hardship.
Yeah. that's
in this century, no hardship.
No.
Because when Ned comes back to England, he's involved in a rebellion against King James II and his wife, Queen Mary of Modena. And his family, Ned's family, takes the royalist side also. So you have this kind of civil war being fought out inside the family as well as in the country. But the punishment for those who are captured after the battle against James II and his wife Mary of Modena was by and large transportation. There were a lot of executions, but there were a lot of transportations as well. And the English government then sent white people as into servitude into Barbados, where they worked alongside enslaved people of African descent. And Rowan gets caught up in this battle and gets sent to Barbados also. So ironically, someone who in our first chapter is rescued from a life of slavery in the Sugar Islands finds herself towards the end of the book enslaved on a sugar island. And it's her determination to survive that and the perseverance and the courage that she shows that I found really, really inspiring in the book. It for me, it really lights up that last section set in Barbados.
It definitely does. One of the things, of course, the nice thing about the whole series is that there are so many wonderful characters in the book, and we get to have a deeper insight into them in this third book. Everybody who's read the book will remember Livia. She's like a rather unforgettable character. And of course, Johnny and everybody, you know, loves Ned. So it's really wonderful the way that you put the stories together and the character development and the background here. You know, as I said, as we're heading now into the coronation of a new king, a king named Charles, I think people will be a little bit intrigued to know what was going on, who the first, you know, the Charles before him was. So that's fascinating. Then, of course, you're also very deeply involved in Sussex. And, of course, that's a subject here that everybody's talking about. So because you are, you work for the university, you're at the university or...
Yes, I attended the university. I got my BA from the University of Sussex, and I'm a regent and representative of the university internationally as well. Yes.
Yes, because
it's my alma mater.
I think you know, for Americans who didn't know anything about Sussex, they're interested now, and they are, you know, the minute they see that name, they want to know more. So I think that's also, it's just a perfect timing for this book to come out, I think.
It's funny how timely it is. I mean, of course, when I was writing it, the late Queen was still alive. Uh-huh. And Charles was Prince of Wales and had been Prince of Wales for almost as long as I can remember. I can remember his investiture as Prince of Wales. And now, you know, we have a new Charles on the throne. And, you know, I have to say it's been, you know, in the past a very unlucky name. But, you know, we'll see how England takes this new Charles. Though, of course, they're not Stuarts anymore.
No.
And the culture of royalty and the population in England is completely different. But a lot of the way that we manage our monarchy and the way we relate to them is set up in these very years. It's the coming of William and Mary at the end of this novel, which establishes a constitutional monarchy, which has survived, you know, 400 years till today.
Well, you know, of course, who presented you with your CBE? And tell us about that. Was that exciting when you were told that you were being given a CBE? Do you want to explain that to my listeners?
It was tremendously exciting. It's the Order of the Commander of the British Empire, and it's one of the highest orders of a civilian honor that you can get. And I was completely thrilled to be awarded it. And it's it's particularly touching to me because it's one of the last honors that the Queen gave out. So that was really rather wonderful. I actually was invested by Princess Anne at Windsor Castle. And funnily enough, I was writing about Windsor Castle because the royal family were using Windsor Castle as a home in the novel. So I was both writing about it and thinking about it in 1688 and going into it this very year to get my award. It was extraordinary. It was it's one of those moments where you kind of pinch yourself when you're not sure what date it is, because Windsor Castle, you know, with the footmen in all of their uniform and the military in their beautiful uniform and Princess Anne in her uniform and the incredible wealth and beauty of the castle, it's literally like stepping back in time. It's quite extraordinary.
Well, I think it's, of course, you know, for any British person, it's such an honor. But what I found interesting, you know, when you think about it, when you were a little girl, did you ever imagine that you would get a CBE?
No, of course not. No, when I was a little girl, I never imagined I'd be a historian or I'd be a writer either. I mean, it's just not, you know, when I wanted to be a vet. And my mother wanted me to marry well. So, you know, like, in a sense, to make my own fortune and to have my own career is something that I didn't dream of. And I'm profoundly grateful for the success I've had.
Well, of course, so did that mean you loved horses when you were a little girl?
I loved horses, and you can see my love of animals through all the books. I think there's a beloved animal in almost every story, and certainly there's some great horses in this book, as there are in all of my books. Yes, I'm very, very fond of horses, and I have now a very, very adored red setter called Butter, my dog.
Well, I'm sure, you know, the Queen Elizabeth would have loved talking to you. I don't know if you ever got a chance to talk to her, but boy, oh boy, not just, of course, she was great on the history of the royal family. I understand she was really like a walking encyclopedia. Sometimes people don't think about royals reading about the past, but I know that she did. And I'm sure she read your books. I know anybody who's interested in British history has to read your books. They are just marvelous. My friend Margaret George, one of the first things she said to me when I went to visit her up in Wisconsin, she said, do you want to see my Philippa Gregory collection? Because everybody loves your books.
Yes, Margaret's very, very kind. She's such a great writer herself, and you know her research is so strong. I like her books also. We're a mutual admiration society, and you know, yes, funnily enough, because my books tend to be published in the fall, towards the end of the summer, I always send one to the now Queen Consort. She was then the Duchess Camilla, and she used to read them when she was on holiday in Balmoral, and she always said that she wanted... I changed publication date one year, and she complained to me that she didn't have a book for her Balmoral stay. So, you know, it's quite an honour, really, to know that the royal family enjoy the books also.
Well, the new book is fantastic. I hope everyone will get it. It's just amazing. And I love going, you know, in these difficult times, somehow going back in time is so relaxing and so refreshing in so many ways. So I think it's just wonderful that the new book has come out. People get it. It's wonderful. As I said, it's very timely, very interesting as it relates to our own Thanksgiving and the people who made it possible. So again, Philippa Gregory, I just want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. You are a joy. The new book, of course, is Don Lands. It's available. Oh, and we get to hear. This is from the Fair Mile series. Okay, and in this book, we get to find out why Fair Mile, right? So.
Absolutely. This is what in England we call gentrification, that what was, as the original family home, a very, very muddy, damp, horrible little cottage, and our heroine from book one returns finally and becomes a squire at the house where once she was a servant.
Well, by the way, when I moved to England, I bought a 400-year-old cottage, so I know what an old cottage is like. I had dry rot and I had wet rot, so...
absolutely. I have both dry rot and wet rot in my current house.
Oh,
thank you very much.
Yes, well.
And the builder said to me, what you don't want to do is to stop the drafts, because that's what's keeping the house dry.
Yeah. living in England was such a joy for me. And every time I can hear a British accent, I am thrilled. I will be smiling all day. Philippa Gregory, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. You are a true joy, and it is just an honor to speak to you.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye. Wow. Oh, wow. What a honor, because she is such a terrific author. You just have to read her books. As I said to her, you get lost in her books. You have an entire... Just her characters are so alive. After a while, when you start the series, you don't have to start the series, you can start with this book and then go back, and this book is called Don Lands, but the first book, which was called Tidelands, when I started reading that book, I think I forgot about everything else, and that was, you know, a time when you needed to not think about anything, and it's just wonderful, and I'm just so honored that she was on today. I'm going to... Do I have my next guest? Not yet. So we're going to play a book buzz from Bria Burton, because it's just fantastic. And then we'll be back with my next guest.
Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2022 release in ebook, Ruthless Positivity by Avery Blake. Now, let's download the book buzz. When hacker Cam establishes her online persona inside a virtual reality called Escape, she programs her own upgrades, raising herself up from real-life poverty to become a wealthy business owner inside the virtual reality. But if anyone in or out of Escape finds out that everything Cam has comes from her hacking skills, in other words, it's all stolen, her chronically ill body in real life will be arrested and imprisoned for what little time she has left on Earth. Her only hope is to perform a risky, never-before-accomplished hack that would upload her conscious permanently into Escape. Enter Lyle, the handsome and famous son of Ruthless Positivity creator Julia Grace, a self-help icon who spouts ridiculous idioms that everyone inside and out of Escape seems to drink up like Kool-Aid. Before Cam's mentally ill father died, he emotionally abused her with the same jargon sold by ruthless positivity. Cam battles her attraction to Lyle while witnessing his unhealthy, codependent relationship with his narcissistic mother, Julia Grace. A warning from Cam's AI assistant means she's running out of time, and Lyle might be the only person she can risk trusting in the real world and the virtual world. This fast-paced standalone novel will keep readers turning pages as the clock ticks down on Cam, her disease-ridden body like a time bomb waiting to destroy all her hopes of living a blissful existence in Eastgate for all eternity. Author Avery Blake is obsessed with all things sci-fi. She writes stories about the things that fascinate and occasionally terrify her, and the potential futures humanity might have. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off.
Okay, thank you, Bria. I am so happy now to welcome my next guest, and I'm trying to lift up this book, but it weighs a ton. Marcy Smothers, hi, how are you?
Are you still there? If you are satisfied with your message, press 1 to listen to your message.
Oh,
press
boy.
2.
What happened to Marcy? Is Marcy there? Okay, well, I'm just waiting for Marcy to call back because, as I said, this is a heavy book. Anyway, I'm going to be... She better call back because I'm leaving early today. I have to go to the airport, and I was planning to leave early, but I will wait and talk to Marcy. I'm so happy... I love gift books, and this is a perfect gift book. I tell you, if you're visiting anybody on Thanksgiving, you will want to bring this book with you, and it will keep everybody enthralled for the entire time while they're waiting for their turkey, because people always drive me crazy when I make the turkey and I say, you know, it's going to be at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock. Wait, but if you have a good book, it's okay. Hey, Marcy, are you there? Not yet. I'm waiting for Marcy. My goodness, goodness gracious. But as I was saying, it's wonderful to have a great book for your guests when they come to Thanksgiving dinner. Is she on? Hey, Marcy, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, great. Because I'm telling everybody to get this book and take it with them if they're invited for Thanksgiving dinner, or if they're doing it at home, to have it on their coffee table. Because it'll keep everybody busy between the time they're waiting for the turkey and then the time they're waiting for the big game. This is a wonderful book.
I love book. That.
100 Disney adventures of a lifetime. Magical experiences from around the world. Marcy, you have put together an absolutely fabulous book.
Well, thank you. It's a complete honor to write for National Geographic. And this is the first collaboration of Nat Geo and Disney, so it's extra special because I'm a Disney geek.
Well, and I'm a Nat Geo geek.
Perfect.
I was raised on Nat Geo, and of course I love all of their books. But every Thanksgiving is a Nat Geo gift day for me. I always give a Nat Geo book because I think it's perfect. The wonderful thing about Nat Geo books is nobody ever puts them in a garage sale. They are treasures that people keep forever.
That is such a great point. I love that sentiment. You know, I might actually copy you for this Thanksgiving. It would be appropriate.
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead. And the book is lovely, and I love all the pictures of Walt Disney. And just tell us about how you came up with this idea and how you did this book.
Well, it was National Geographic's idea. They were acquired by the Disney Company in 2019. And since we'll be celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Walt Disney Company in 2023, they thought, well, why don't we do one of our 100 books, but do it about the best Disney adventures in the world? So we started with about, Nat Geo had vetted about 40 different adventures across the board from the different platforms within Disney and Nat Geo Adventures by Disney, the cruises, the parks, etc. And then I came on board. And together as a team, we just looked at everything that you could do. And there's a few things that were very important to me. One was that they all didn't have to be bucket list expensive things. They could be free. So I think that I worked really hard for this large span of everything from achievable to aspirational. The other thing that was really important to me was to include Walt. So thank you for mentioning him earlier. You know, Walt actually had, he's like you, a huge Nat Geo fan. And when he was researching his movies as early as the 30s, he installed an entire National Geographic library at studio. and that still exists today. So another thing that I wanted in honor of Walt and the 100th anniversary was Adventures with Walt entries, where the reader can get to know Walt Disney, not the legend or just the legend, but also the man, and to go visit the places that influenced and inspired him.
That's what I loved about this book. All the photos of Walt Disney, you know, his face just radiates joy. That's the word that came to mind as I was going through it. Every photo of him, he's just so joy-filled. You know that behind, you know, the face and the great mind of his, he has all these wonderful ideas, and it shows. It shows on his face.
I just adore also that you shared that. That's the word I use all the time. All the time, is the great joy that he possessed, and the fact that that joy he wanted for people watching his movies, the joy he wanted and the magic he wanted people to feel when they were in his park, still exists today, all those years since he passed in 1966. So whatever it was that he was able to capture that you're seeing in those photos is still evident in these Disney adventures today. And that's a lot of credit that goes to the Imagineers and the cast members that are continuing his legacy and keeping his vision going forward.
Well, you've done a beautiful job. Of course, Nat Geo always has the greatest photos. And the stories behind the different adventures I found so fascinating. Tell us a little bit about something that's going on in Japan.
Oh, well, I mean, there are two of the most beautiful parks there, Tokyo Disneyland and Tokyo Disney Sea. And I haven't had the opportunity to visit there yet. That's very, 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 very high on my personal wish list. But these parks were the first international parks. A lot of people aren't aware of that after Walt Disney World was built. And they are simply exquisite. There's many the attractions that are the same, like you would see at Disneyland and Walt Disney World, but they have their vision, the Japanese vision. But Disneyland itself, Tokyo Disneyland is very much like Disneyland in California. And it's also where you'll see a lot of the Duffys, which I made an entrance. The Duffys, we know Mickey Mouse and we know some of these other characters so well, and the plushies that could be are collectible, but the Duffys and Duffy and his friends, this cute little bear, has its own beautiful little story, and it's very, very popular in Tokyo.
Well, there's one horrible thing about this book, absolutely horrible. It just drove me, oh, it's just awful. The photos of the food, make you crazy. I want everything. It's wonderful. Oh my goodness.
But Tessa, there's one thing. You see, for me, I really am a Disney geek first and foremost before I'm an author. I am the reader as much as I'm the writer. And my first book for Disney was Eat Like Walt, The Wonderful World of Disney Food. So I hear you. I have your back on that, because there's everything from, you know, the iconic snack food, kind of tangential things about how popular it is to collect the popcorn buckets, where you can go and eat like Walt in the same restaurants that Walt Disney ate at in Los Angeles. And then we have some super high-tier dining experiences like Victoria and Albert's at Walt Disney World, where you could eat in the chef's kitchen and it's on the level of a French Laundry experience. Or the super-duper one that I'm just also super high on my personal wish list is 21 Royal. And that was going to be Walt Disney's second apartment at Disneyland. His original one is above the firehouse, which is also one of our adventures. This one, Walt was building in New Orleans Square, but never lived. And so to enjoy it, it actually was never completed in his lifetime. Now it's a restaurant, and for a very high fee, but I think, you know, it's worth it for 12 people. You can sit and eat in Walt Disney's dining room and have a multi-course meal, second floor, looking over New Orleans Square, seeing the nighttime spectaculars. So that would be an example of one of our aspirational dining experiences. And one that's quite achievable, there's so many, but again, at Walt Disney World would be our guest restaurant in the Beast Castle. I mean, you feel like you walk into the movie and you're eating in Beast Castle. It's just absolutely staggering.
Oh, it is wonderful. These photos, I want that little red wagon. I need to go to the corn dog cart. That's
the best corn dog, yes.
Wow. Oh, I just love it. It's absolutely delightful. And as I said, when I do this thing, well, before the pandemic, because, you know, it's like, pandemic threw everything. There weren't any of these get-togethers that normally I have a very, very big Thanksgiving dinner. And what I've done over the years is I've turned my Nat Geo book of the day, of Thanksgiving Day, into something very, you know, similar to the school yearbook. I ask everybody who's a guest that day to write in the book. Normally, I don't write in books. You know, they're precious to me. But when you turn a Nat Geo book into a you know, a book where people actually write little notes and sign their name, particularly with kids, because you save these books anyway. You're never going to get rid of these books. And then to go back and look over the different Thanksgivings and see, you know, how the kids' handwriting changes and how, you know, maybe in the beginning they can just sign their name and then 10 years later they can write you a whole beautiful message. So that's what I always promote. Thanksgiving Day is Nat Geo Day for me. So
that is lovely tradition. I mean, I really am thinking of doing that with the 100 Disney Adventures of a Lifetime, passing it around, and everybody, they're all going to say they can't pick their favorite, but they're going to have to pick their favorite and write a little note. So may I ask you, what would be your favorite of these 100? It's actually more than 100, a lot more. But
yeah,
what would
I was
going to
say.
Your favorite, what would you pick?
Well, I don't know. I got fixated a little bit on the corn dogs.
I love it. Well, you know what? Okay, let's talk corn dogs at Disneyland in particular. Jonathan Gold, who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer, deemed the corn dog at Disneyland from that little red wagon the best corn dog in America.
I believe it. I want it.
So you have to have one. But, you know, I think with the food at Disney, that a big part of it is, of course, we eat with our eyes, but what Disney knows so well is it's this complete sensory experience. So you're hearing the music, you're seeing the, you know, the way that it's presented on the plate, which is a whole nother place in Walt Disney World called the Flavor Lab. It's almost impossible to get into, top secret, but that's where they develop all their recipes, and that's where they decide what the foodscape's going to look like and the tablescapes and what type of utensils will be used. But I do think whatever food you're eating at any Disney enterprise, even cruises and resorts included, when you, it's not just the food itself, and that's why it tastes so much better.
I think so. And I love that one of the photos in it is the Walt Disney Hometown Museum. I think most people don't know about it, but I found that fascinating.
Well, I thank you for bringing that up, because that's really, really, I mean, I can never pick a favorite, but I'm going to put that in my top 10 and incredibly important to me to include, because Walt and Marceline, he always called it his hometown. He talks about it often. Almost any really basic Disney, you know, fan has heard him talk about how important Marceline was to him. And this museum is in his hometown. He actually lived there for 4 years, which is another kind of fun fact, because his daughters thought, he talked about it all the time, almost every, you know, constantly, and they thought he was born and raised there. It wasn't until they're adults they found out he only had 4 years there, but four of the most important years of his life. That museum is filled with unique memorabilia you'll see nowhere else. Then also the town itself. There's the E.P. Ripley Park, which was part of Walt's inspiration to name one of the locomotives at Disneyland, E.P. Ripley. There is their Main Street USA called Kansas Avenue there, and many, many inspirations for Main Street at Disneyland came from that street and his hometown. I consider going to Marceline a pilgrimage. If you are a fan of Walt Disney, if you want to get to know the man, Marceline's the place to go. And you're going to be the first, I tell anybody, but I'm going to be in Marceline on July 3rd, and we are rolling out the red carpet and having a big Nat Geo Day, 100 Disney Adventures of a Lifetime Day in Marceline, because Walt loved his fireworks. And that's when he saw him in the town of Marceline. That's why the parks worldwide have fireworks, because that's where Walt first saw them. And when his guests are leaving the park, he calls it a kiss goodbye. It's his way of saying goodbye to his guests with that grand nighttime spectacular. So I am really excited to be celebrating this book at Marceline over the 4th of July weekend next year.
Well, I'm so happy that I brought it up, because it's funny. It was one of the pages that I kept going back to, because I didn't know there was anything in Marceline. I'd heard about it, but I didn't know. And so I found that so fascinating. And now to find out that there's actually going to be a big event, it's exciting.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I can see why you'd be attracted to that, because it really is also, you know, represents a lot of what Disney is and Nat Geo is, you know, which is family curiosity. I mean, that's one thing that I think is so interesting. You know, Walt was, like you, very fascinated by Nat Geo, and he installed a National Geographic library at the studio in the early 30s for him and for all of his Imagineers, artists, and designers to use as a reference for the movies. And that actually still exists. And one of Nat Geo's mottos is, you know, be curious. And one of Walt's statements that he said over and over again is, if you're curious, you find lots of interesting things to do. So curiosity is a theme that I like to see runs in and out of the book, and particularly at Marceline, because so many people don't know about it, and I want so many people to know about it.
Well, you've done a beautiful job. This is a fantastic book, and I am so happy that I, you know, was able to bring it forward to people, because I am a product of Nat Geo. I was raised in northern Michigan, and we were very poor. The only subscription we had to anything was Nat Geo, and we would wait. Mm-hmm. We would wait for that magazine, and we treasured it. And it opened the world to us. And that's why I became a world traveler. Just from reading Nat Geo at a very young age, I said, I'm going to go to all these places. And I've done a pretty good job of doing a lot of it. So, you know, I just owe so much, really, of my life to Nat Geo. I look back and I see that, you know, I would not be the same person if I had not had Nat Geo at a young age. And I see why, you know, I relate so well to Walt Disney, because we have that same wonderful, it opened our imaginations. And that's
right.
That's what Nat Geo books do for everybody. And there's a wonderful Nat Geo book for everybody. Any subject, you guys have a book. And I think you've done a wonderful job with this book. You know, when you get something and you have it in your hand and you hold it in your hand and you see the quality, of course, always the wonderful paper. I was trying to lift this book. You know, it's a little book. You know, it's not a big, big, giant book, but it's so heavy. That's because the quality of the paper. It will last for generations. That's why if you turn it into a yearbook style thing with messages, it will be handed down for generations.
I'm actually crying. You have said something so eloquently and beautiful. I can't wait to call my editor, Alice, and tell her about this call on you. Everything that we worked so hard putting this book together in record time, and to hear those sentiments, and especially about Nat Geo, because I couldn't agree with you more. It is extremely special. And another quality, I think, of this book is the photographs that we would expect from National Geographic, you know, just riveting, beautiful. The stories in themselves, they almost don't need captions except for if you want to know the details. But you could get immersed and just lost in the storytelling and the images alone. And then that's another big signature of a National Geographic book.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Marcy Carricker Smothers. You've done a beautiful job. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about the foreword that was written for
Joe Rohde?
Yeah.
I mean, I had so many dreams come true writing this book. We could talk a long time about that. But Joe Rohde is what I consider Disney's ultimate adventurer. Simply put, because he's had a giant career. But you might know him mostly he was the lead designer for Disney's Animal Kingdom and Aulani in Hawaii. He has deep respect for history and cultures around the world and is a world traveler and an adventurer. Goes all over Asia and Africa just to research every single element you will notice or maybe not notice but sense at Disney's Animal Kingdom. And so when I was asked to write the book, the first thing I said was, I know who I want to write the foreword, and that's Joe Rohde. And I had no idea if he would agree. He's huge. He's a superstar. So it was the highest honor of my life when he agreed. I think that foreword also brought me to tears because it speaks so much about how adventures at Disney, just like you were saying, how reading Nat Geo magazines and his foreword, he talks about how adventures at Disney has inspired new adventurers and new artists and new designers. Maybe one singular experience has set them off on a life career path or has told them where they want to travel. So thank you to Joe Rohde for writing the introduction. And I've had the honor to do a panel with him at D23 Expo. And basically, I just wanted to hand him the mic and say, will you just talk? And I just want to listen.
Okay. Well, you know, Marcy, I have to go now, but I want to thank you again for being on Joy on Paper. You are just fantastic. I love the joy in your voice, and I know that Walt Disney would have loved you too. So again, the book is 100 Disney Adventures of a Lifetime, Magical Experiences from Around the World. It's a Nat Geo book. It's available wherever books are sold. You can go to Nat Geo Books online. Also, and of course, in bookstores all over the place. get this book for Thanksgiving. Get one for your own coffee table and then bring it to everybody you go visit during the holidays. It's just wonderful. Kids will love it. It's for everybody, you know, young and to 110, because people will just spend hours reading this book. Thank you, Marcy.
Thank you so much, and I wish you a joyful day.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Okay. This is a wonderful book, everybody. I have to run. I'm running to the airport, and I'm going to turn it over to Big Ed, and I salute him because he always does everything so well. So we're going to have some commercials, and then he's going to play another book buzz and some of my favorite songs, songs that always make me feel good, and I hope they make you feel good, because I am off to the airport. Bye-bye now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Been stowed away on this boxcar for quite some time. We plan to ride it. Company's gone. I could choose to step off and make my way back home, or I could choose to keep moving on. My time is come and gone. Maybe I'll stay my welcome, but I've outgrown this boxcar and I'm headed down the boxcar. My time is come and gone. Maybe I'll overstay my welcome, but I've outgrown this boxcar and I'm headed down the rails. I'm headed down the rails again. I'm headed down the rails again.
Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Tock Clock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. Last month, Hurricane Ian made landfall in the Sunshine State of Florida, which meant that so many theme parks containing roller coasters were shut down. Now that Ian is gone, theme parks featuring roller coasters are back open to the public. And now that they're open, I know the Pigeon is certainly going to ride on them. Yes, the Pigeon, one of the characters created by children's author and illustrator Mo Willems. The Pigeon makes a return in the book, The Pigeon Will Ride the Roller Coaster, written and illustrated by Mo Willems. Mo Willems isn't a big fan of roller coasters, but the last couple of years for him learning to adapt was a real roller coaster for him. It eventually turned into the idea of The Pigeon Will Ride the Roller Coaster. Fasten your seatbelts for an emotional story full of twists, turns, and loop-de-loops as the Pigeon will be ready to ride the roller coaster. The question is, will you be ready? I think after reading this book, you'll certainly find me ready to ride along with the Pigeon. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Sometimes I feel like giving up and throwing in the towel. Sometimes I can't hardly face another day. I am assured that God will see me through. It's working for my good. It's working for my good. Sometimes the clouds hang low. Change for me. I am assured that God will see me through. It's working for my good. It's working for
is worth.